From Hetzel Studios in Dublin, welcome to Mother Folklore, a podcast of words,
Irish
words,
and words from Ireland.
I'm Dara Hushay.
And I'm surprised by the fact that I had to take a full part in the intro.
Yeah.
I'm Pather O'Connor.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I should swipe in either. I'm Geraldine McAvoy.
You see, I couldn't point at you, Geraldine, so that's why we were...
Well, we did, he pointed at Helsinki. He just pointed in the general direction of Helsinki, and lo and behold, there you were.
Geraldine, what's better, Turku or Helsinki?
Well, I'm in neither of those places now, but thanks anyway. I would say probably I'm going to have to say Turku. I prefer Turku to Helsinki. Helsinki's nice. There's more amenities there. But like Turku is like Cork. It's like the Finnish Cork.
I knew it.
So I love it.
Every country has a Cork.
Yeah, and it's Turku. And people who've never lived there don't love it. They're like, oh, it's shit. And I'm like, that's because you've not lived there. It's the same as Cork. It's the Paris of the North.
Oh, famously so, yes. Oh,
it's Paris of Europe. So Geraldine and Pather, we have a very special guest in the studio today.
Yay!
We've talked a little bit about publishing in Ireland recently and publishing the Irish language, but we haven't had a writer in some time. And we are delighted and excited to welcome Saif Devlin.
Hi, Gachtina.
Welcome in, Sai. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Lynn. Thank you. So excited to be here.
Yeah. Sai, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I'm from Bray. Wasn't Tóca le Gaeilge, so have all my Gaeilge from Nínra right up to Gael School and beyond into university. Started writing always and wrote all through, had a blog, this, that and the other, and eventually at a creative writing class where I was happily writing away in English, the teacher asked me, oh, have you never written as Gaeilge? And I said, do you know what? No, I haven't. That's my second language. I wouldn't really be able for that. Creatively anyway, like I couldn't imagine myself doing it. But it kind of that lodged in my brain and then I started trying it and then... Now I have books, Osgoelge.
Books, Osgoelge. For the harshest audience of all, you are a children's author.
Yes. So far I've had two picture books published. I don't do the drawings much as I'd love to be able to, but that means I get to work with amazing illustrators. And you're right, children will tell you straight out whether they like it or whether they don't like it or whether they think that page is ridiculous or, you know, even down to the minutest detail, I don't like their name, you know, they'll tell you straight out. So, yeah, they're a tough audience. But I love that. I love that honesty and that straight talking. It's good.
Would you tell us what your books are called?
Okay, so my first book is called Be Exprilum, Come Play With Me. And it's a story about a little girl called Luna. And Luna really wants to play with her mom. And I guess it's kind of a true story because it's all about the guilt tripping as a parent when you're really, really busy and you'd love to be playing with your kid, but really, realistically, you don't have time and you'd kind of fob them off. I'll be there in 2 minutes. Just a minute. One more minute. And eventually, so Luna's kind of left her own device for a while and she tries to come up with a few inventions to get her mom to play with her.
Oh.
We can't spoil the ending, right?
I won't spoil the ending.
It's available in all good bookstores.
It is.
That's something that something I've been thinking about a lot recently because I know there was a friend of mine was mentioning that when he'd been talking to his father that the reason his father stopped smoking was any time he had drawn a picture of his daddy, the daddy always had a cigarette in his hand.
Oh, God, wow.
And I've been thinking about this recently because La Serena, when she's running around the house, she's very interested in our phones. And whenever she gets the phone, she's walking around holding the phone to her ear going, bah, 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 dad, 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 dad. Because I possibly think yes to that. The children will always do what they say, but they'll do what you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Friend of mine was saying just the other day, she realized her 1.5-year-old woke up and got up and went over and grabbed Mammy's phone and brought it over to Mammy and handed it to her. Because that's what Mammy does first thing in the morning, check the phone. And so my friend is a politician. She's constantly on the phone, constantly getting messages. But she said it really inspired her to just, you know what, this weekend, phone's going off.
Yeah.
I'll check it maybe 3 times and I'll get back to anything urgent. But no, this is about me and the babby for the weekend. I'm not going to. And I thought that was lovely, but it did take that little moment of,
Yeah.
What am I
They
doing?
Hold up a mirror to you in a way that, you know, other grown-ups will kind of dance around and not tell you it's straight. And they just have this way of doing it. But like my kids now use my book against me. Like if I'm now fobbing So if I'm now fobbing them off and they're like, you're just like the mom and be Exprelum. So
oh, you'll play with Luna, but you won't play with me.
Yeah, so it kind of backfired.
But I think that's so nice. I think it goes back to that same idea, like you said earlier, about like the honesty of kids, like that if like they have no preconceptions about anything. So like if you're doing something, they're going to do it back to you, like, and don't care how that's going to make you feel, like make you realize that like, oh, I'm on my phone all the time or whatever it is. The same with like their honesty about a book. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also you see that in like how much they enjoy, like it's just pure when they do enjoy a book, like a child will just purely enjoy it. And it's such a wonderful thing to see when a child is like creased laughing at a book or really enjoying a book or wants that book to be read again. Like it's the sweetest thing. They just enjoy it so much. So it just must be such a nice audience to have. Other, at the same time as being harsh, but such a nice audience also.
Oh, such a nice audience. They're so up for fun, you see. When I just spend a lot of time in libraries and in schools doing readings, and it's such a joy because you get that instant feedback. But also you get to have fun because I'll do little bits of movement or I'll ask them questions throughout and, you know, get them to kind of identify, like, do you have grown-ups at home that say I'll be there in a minute all the time? They're like, oh my God, yeah! You know?
It's like she knows my life. Yeah.
So it's really funny when they identify with that. I love it.
So tell us about your second book.
The second book is called Bjugbidach. And it's about a little girl called Nina. And Nina has a little brother called Jimmy. So Jimmy kind of wants to play with her and she's a bit fed up because she wants to play on her own. So her favourite toy...
I see you learned your lesson because Luna didn't want to play on her own. Like, next time I write a little girl, that bitch is going to be able to play on her own.
We actually had a joke about that when we were trying to come up with the title because, you know, you often have a working title and then you come up with the actual title. So we actually had an in joke with the publisher that we were going to call it Nobby Exprelum. Don't play with me. And it kind of fits. Nina has a favourite toy, like a lot of kids do, and her favourite toy is her dolls and her dollhouse. So she wants to be Bjugbidach so she can go and live with her dolls and her doll's house and without Jimmy, so Jimmy can't kind of annoy her. Mm-hmm. So she manages to do that. So she,
amazing.
Yeah.
Dreacht.
Dreacht. Kind of dreacht. But sort of, I think the inspiration for that book was actually Where the Wild Things Are by Mara Sendak, and just that idea of a child going into their imagination and into that sort of world that we as adults, we forget how to get there. You know, they're really, really immersed in that world. And I think that was one of the big inspirations for that book. And then also the fact that it was one of my greatest desires as a child to be Bjugbidach.
What was your favourite toy? Was it a doll?
Yeah. My uncle made me this dollhouse. Now, it was for my Sylvanians. The Sylvanians were really, Sylvanian families were prohibitively expensive in the 80s for my family anyway. And I had a few figurines, but my uncle actually made me like a wooden version of the houses, which I still have and it's still like really well made. So it's in perfect condition. My daughters play with it now. But I used to like lie in bed every night going, oh, I wish I was teeny tiny. I wish when I open my eyes, I'm going to be in that dollhouse with my Sylvanians.
Oh my God, I love this. I'm relating so hard to this. Like, I know this is supposed to be about your books, but let's talk more about Sylvanian
I still collect them.
Oh my God, I love them. Listen, anybody who, you want a good time, you want some pure internet content, follow the Sylvanian family's Twitter page. Yes. Like, it is just pure like goodness. Adorable content, like it's so heartwarming and sweet. Like, and every now and then they give away shit, and I'm entering that like nobody's business. Like,
they're so gorgeous.
It started off when Guardian, you're talking, this sounded like toilet graffiti for a good time. Cole, Sylvanians.
Do you know what though? There is actually a kind of risque version. Someone using Sylvanian families doing naughty things.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
we cannot
no.
What's the URL? We cannot. No. Oh, where
so
can I find
it? It's a Twitter feed. I think it's like Forest Family or something like that. I can't remember. I haven't looked at it in a while because it would soil my eyes.
Sociopaths
would do that. Total tangent, but there's a fantastic website called The Brick Testament where people reenact Bible verses using Lego figures.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. Particularly gets to like Deuteronomy and Leviticus, they start talking about the laws of the ancient Hebrews and what people could get stoned for. And you got the guys throwing, they have the little, the circular one piece that looks a little bit like a rock and they're throwing it at other Lego men. It's hilarious.
So similar thing, but just little cute creatures doing really dodgy things.
I loved Sylvanian families when I was a kid because my cousins had them. So it was great to play with them. But like you say, they were prohibitively expensive. The closest I ever got was like to look at the Argos catalogue and use my imagination about the Sylvanian families that were there.
Yeah.
That was my childhood. Thanks, mom and dad.
I tell you.
I had some Sylvanian families, but I think it was later. I was like older when I got them, like because they were too like good quality
like
and expensive
22.
For a reckless child, like, you know. Yes, I still have them now.
But they last forever.
Like one of my friends had older sisters and older cousins who like had a collection of them. So she had this, to me, it seemed like a theme park of Sylvanian family like worlds, but it was probably like three like separate houses. Like, but to me, it was like the most amazing thing. So I used to love going to her house to play with her Sylvanian families. She had an amazing collection of Barbies as well by virtue of having older sisters and stuff. But with
Barbies, with Sylvanian families, and when I was growing up, it was toy soldiers. It was green army men, plastic army men, and then some tin soldiers that I got from relatives and all that. It's all about imagination.
Yeah.
It's all about building this world. You know, like there's a brilliant poem I, you know, grew up reading, the Land of Counterpane. It's about a boy who's sick and imagining hills and villages right there on his bedspread because he can't leave the bed. And how do you tap into that? How do you put that onto paper, that world of imagination? Because obviously what you think up and what you, and when you work with an illustrator, you have another imagination there as well.
Yes.
So how do you try and capture a generic, there's no such thing as a generic child, obviously, but a generic child's imagination on paper?
Well, I think you don't really go for the generic child. I think that's the thing. You tap into your own, or like watching my children, like the first book was inspired by a conversation my daughter and I had. And then the second one was very much a memory of my own. And I think finding something that's authentic, that's real, is the only way to do it. Because I think there's so many of those books that you find and they're just the generic story, but they don't do very well and they're not classics. They're not that I'm saying my books are future classics or anything, but
current classics.
Yes. Well, the second one did get nominated for a Children's Books Ireland shortlisted for an award, so Book of the Year award. So we didn't win or anything.
I don't like being in a room where I'm actually outnumbered by celebrated authors.
Yes. So yes, current classic. It's in the top 10 in Ireland at the moment, I guess.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And like let's be fair, that's a big market. There's a lot of stuff out there for kids. Like
yes,
a lot
it's
of books
huge.
Out there.
This is something I wanted to really ask you because when I started kind of the Irish Four and the Mother Folklore, people were saying, "Oh, you should knock out an old kids book." I mean, you know, anyone. My daughter has all these kids books, and most of them are shite. Mm. And you know, any old Egypt. And I was like, no, it's kids are so particular about what's good and what isn't. And there's just the perception that anyone can knock out a kid's book perpetuated by certain celebrity authors who have name recognition.
Yeah. Yes.
So obviously the celebrity children's author thing, bit of a problem.
It can be because I think it swamps other work that's coming out that is equally good or sometimes an awful lot better. And I think because they have that platform, you know, it just makes it harder for everybody else because it does drown out and people will know their names. And, you know, even if they're not celebrities to current children, their parents will know the names and they'll go, oh, yeah, he was funny on the telly. I'll buy this book. He must be funny for kids. I'll buy that book for my kids.
Because my daughter hasn't heard of BJ Novak. Like, my daughter doesn't watch The Office.
Yeah, exactly. But you're going to go, oh, he's a cool guy who makes funny comedy. I'll buy that book.
Yeah.
I think his book's very good, though.
Fair enough.
So do you just look at these celebrity children's authors and you just do your best Bane impression? Like, you think the children are your ally?
Not really. I think there's room for, you know, there's room for everybody. It's all different slices of the pie and you just do your own thing. Because I think if you're trying to compare yourself, it's just the death of creativity.
The test, I think, that someone else had mentioned is that real children's authors are always talking about how much they love kids' books, always recommending other children's authors they love, whereas often the celebrity children's authors only talk about themselves.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah, and you would read widely. Like, one of my favourite things to do is my girls go to Brownies on a Tuesday evening and it's like an hour and 15 minutes, which is like the weirdest length class ever. But the library is right across the road and it's open late that day. So I go to the library and I just take like a stack of picture books and I just sit and will read for that hour as many picture books. And I'm sitting, everyone else is studying and like doing really complicated looking things and I've just got this like stack like
the librarian
to my eyeball.
Like, right, yeah. Here's the poor creature back. She's not great at the reading. She does the picture books there every week. She comes in. I'm not sure she has the reading.
I know, that's literally what I fear.
You know, Nala have a class, you know, if you're interested, they have it on a Wednesday night there if you're not good with the reading.
That's exactly what it looks like. But I don't care because I love reading them. And you'll read good ones, you'll read bad ones, you'll read in between ones, you'll read ones that blow your mind and you wish you could write that well. And but I think it's really important to know what's out there and know. And then so you don't just fabricate the same story again, you know.
Are there kind of universal elements to stories, though? Because when you look at simple stories, the stories that we all grew up with, like even mythology, there's an awful lot been written about how basically there is one monomyth and we all sort of slap into it. Is there one Joseph Campbell-style one single children's story that everything sort of slots in and out of, or are there common tropes?
It's almost like a formula for picture books. So there's 32 pages in a picture book.
Oh.
The story happens over 12 double spreads. In it, you have your hero, you've got your problem. You might have your rule of three, where three things happen, or they try three different things to solve the problem or change their situation. There'll be the twist, and then there has to be like a satisfying ending.
Mm-hmm.
So the ending, that doesn't mean necessarily that it's a happy ending or a sad ending or anything. It has
just
be
resolve the story.
a resolution. Yeah. So that's kind of the formula, which sounds really simple and basic. And then you try and make it. But then you have to make that interesting.
You can fit anything around that, though. I mean, that's a formula. Okay, that's fine. But like, that's infinite. Like, when you think about maybe the picture books that you remember reading or the ones that you read to your own kids, like that probably fits to most of them. But like, the possibilities are endless. Like,
they are, exactly. And it's finding that, and it's finding that different take and that different way of looking at it. So my first book, there are so many books about children who want to play with their parents and busy parents, this and the other. There's millions of them out there, but you have to find something in a unique way to tell that story and not just have it in Oscar Aylga.
But it is Oscar Aylga.
It is
and
Oscar Aylga.
That's important. And what's the scene like? What's the market like? I have picture books and books at home for my kid. He can't read yet, but I read them to him. And I love reading ones that are Oscar Aylga. It's a scene, I suppose. It's growing. I'm certainly noticing more.
Yeah.
Maybe because I'm a recent parent, but I think it is a burgeoning sort of scene.
I think it's there's always, it's definitely a scene. And I think it's nice because I've worked in the Irish language since I left university. And I worked with families who are speaking Irish at home or trying to speak Irish at home or wondering how they even start with the basics of using a tiny couple of focal at home. And over the years, there's been so many more. I mean, it's not humongous in terms of publications, but it's so much better now. And the quality of stuff is getting better and better and better. And it holds up to an international standard, definitely. The Irish language books that are being published now are of an international standard that any publisher in the world would publish, if you know what I mean.
This is, again, the great thing about talking about kids' books is that they don't think yours is special because it's Irish.
Yes.
They think it's special because it's good. And they'll be right up and tell you, like, no, that was crap. I don't care what language it was in.
Yes.
I don't care that it's in the minority language you're trying to raise me through, Daddy.
Yes.
This is a shit book and I don't want to read it again.
I know. And I think compared to books that I would have had as a child when there wasn't so much of a scene and everything was being imported from Russia and other Eastern European countries, probably because they were cheap to get them in. And they were not really picture books, even though they had pictures of them. They were like illustrated stories. And the Irish was really government issue. Like, it was really, you know. Mm. And I just never really liked them. Loved Bran. We had Bran.
And, you know,
perfect. And there was a couple of things I liked. But they were all just a bit weird.
Yeah.
And they weren't really...
It was kind of when we got to Gael School age, when we went to the Gael School,
with
Lulu, Nelly, Mickey, Agus, Rira.
Yeah.
That was when shit got real. I loved that. That was engaging characters, overcoming problems, seeking resolutions.
Yes.
Finally. Like, finally. This is
nice
this is
big
good.
Print so we can read it.
There's one book I really enjoy reading to my son. I don't know if you've seen it. It's Abitur by Renee Mullen. It's just an illustrated alphabet,
mm-hmm.
and it's gorgeous. But the problem is that like everything is perfect except for G. G is for gavlog, and I would never have a gavlog in my house. I'd have a fork. Like fork.
Oh, okay, fork.
It's a fork. So I'm reading this to my son. He's going like, you know, F is for fuenio.
There's so many things.
G is for fork.
Gavlog. I've never heard that.
Gavlog.
So gow. Yeah.
Not Glushton.
Okay. No, Glushton. We're not starting that shit again.
Or Gatha.
Gatha could have been listened.
The Swedish for fork is gaffel. So that, I'm just enjoying that. But I've never, like, sorry, that's not the Irish for fork. The Irish for fork is fork.
It's fork.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's still a beautiful book. It's still a lovely little piece of just a nice little educational resource. But it's just fun because the pictures are beautiful.
And it's beautiful. Exactly. And I think that's the thing with picture books. It's really the first... it's the first access a child will have to art in a lot of ways. Mm. So they deserve to have really high quality art. And I've had the pleasure of working with two amazing illustrators so far, Tarsila Cruz for Be Exprelum. And she is from Brazil, Ojus, but she's living in Dublin now and she's learning Irish actually.
Oh,
so, wow.
Yes.
And she's brilliant.
She's amazing.
Such a beautiful book. Like,
yeah, she's fantastic. Gorgeous.
There's a mythical country across the sea in Irish mythology called Brazil, and the surname Brazil comes from that. And it just happens that Brazil was a coincidence, and no one knows how this all got happened. We're going to do a deep dive on that someday.
Oh,
it was the Amazons.
Oh, well, ask Tarsila to come in and make
it. Neurohonic Nastra.
Neurohonic Amazonic. Yeah. They came over to play Camogie against Emmett Gales way back. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So. I'm aware of that. And there's a surname Brazil as well.
There is indeed.
Yeah.
So that's there's
nothing to do with the country. And the other illustrator you worked with for Bug Bidak
is Roisin Hahasi, who is from Tullamore but lives in Brazil. I know. Pure fluke.
I enjoy that.
Yes, I enjoy it.
Isn't that nice?
Neither of them known for their hurling.
Yes. So that was just absolute fluke, but amazing. I love that kind of...
That's remarkable.
Yeah,
that's,
isn't it strange?
A little bit magical.
Yeah. So
what's the process like then? Do you write the story fully formed and then go, you find an illustrator and you say, here's what I have in mind, have at it? Or do you sort of...
So I would write the story... And then I would send it to the publisher and they'd say, no, I don't like that one. Come back again. Come back again with another idea. And you do that a few times. And then you eventually hit on something and they say yes. And so he would find the illustrator. The author of a picture book generally has absolutely no say in who illustrates their books.
Okay.
Oh. So the publisher handles that because the publisher may already have a relationship with various illustrators or may and then if you're a new author, especially because they're taking a risk on you, essentially.
You can't call the shots.
You can't call any shots. And I think probably you can't call any shots in general, like unless you're like Julia Donaldson or something and they're like, she's already got a couple of packages with a couple of illustrators. But yeah, so then the illustrator goes to work and that's the longest part of the process because it's humongous. You're talking about 12 double spreads, full colour. Like it's a big amount of work.
It'll take a day or two, all right.
It just really does. And then...
we have it done by five or should we... Will I order Chinese? Will we hang out? Will we wait?
So, yeah, 24 hours a day probably for a long time. A few months anyway, about 3-4 months.
Wow.
And then... generally, again, the author doesn't get a say in the illustration and it would mostly be handled by the publisher and they would be the ones to feedback and say, no, I don't like that. Can you change the expression on that face or whatever it is? I was very fortunate in that I'd be quite an arty and kind of visual person myself. So Tig, my publisher from Futa Fata, let me have input. So
this is the great Tig.
This is great, Tig McGonagall, absolutely.
The scriptwriter behind Afric,
yes.
Among other things.
Yes.
A huge...
The musical genius behind Raftery, Erin Underground.
The musical genius full stop of all the children's rhymes.
I mean, a major figure in pop culture, Osgelga.
Yes, he's incredible and I always wanted to work with him and I was very fortunate that he picked me up. So I had originally, when that creative writing teacher had said to me, oh, why don't you ever write an Osgoilgan? And I was like, ah, nah, sure, Jesus, wouldn't be able to do that. And but it kind of that little grain stuck there. And I said, well, I might try writing Osgoilgan, but it would have to be nonfiction. Like, it would have to be kind of something factual. I don't think I could, you know, use my imagination in Irish or something. And so I sent...
We are a famously unimaginative people.
So I don't know what the balk there was, considering I started us. Now, I didn't have Irish at home, but I started in Nenagh when I was like 2.5 or something. So, and all the way up and all through college, and then worked all my life Osgoilge and spoke Irish every single day. So I don't know why I had such, you know, fear behind it. But anyway, I said, I'll write something nonfiction. And on my blog, my English language blog, I had been writing different craft projects for kids. And I said, I'll pitch a craft book to him. So I didn't really do my homework properly, because he came back to me and said, nah, no, we don't really do those kind of books. So do you want to, if you have any picture book ideas, send me a picture book idea. And I said, oh, great. Yeah, I have small kids. I read picture books all day, every day. I still have loads of my own from when I was a kid. I'm a big fan of picture books. So I sent him an idea, and he said, just send me a synopsis of an idea. So I sent him a 900 word synopsis. Now, bearing in mind
how many words are in the picture book?
Yeah, like around 500. So he's
and
like,
then,
yeah.
As we turn to page 4, we see the hero's face.
Yes, basically. So very long-winded, terrible synopsis. And he was like, if you can't like synopsize, yeah, if you can't tell the story in like a line, this is not going to work. He said, but he recommended me different resources and different books to read. He was like the kindest. So he's so generous with his knowledge and with his experience. And he told me what to read and how to find out more. And he said, and come back to me if you're interested. So it was through learning more. And then I did a great thing, which is available to anyone who writes Osgoilge for any genre. First na Gaeilge have a thing called Scéim na Nidhi, which is like a mentoring course kind of thing, I suppose, where they pair you up with somebody who is further ahead in their career writing. Wow. And
oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you spend a year.
Who was your Ida?
So Tig was my Ida.
Oh, get in. Nothing but net.
No, he's under no obligation. I mean, I could have been crap, you know. But I was lucky that
this woman, this woman who writes boring synopses actually has a good idea there somewhere, buried deep down.
Eventually, I got a good idea toward like the last bit of the whole year. He said, that one, that's the one, we're going to do that one. So, so I was really lucky. So that was my in, I suppose, to the world of publishing. That's, but I recommend that incredible. Because it's amazing, because you have feedback for a whole year on anything you're writing.
Yeah. And they say everyone has a book in them, don't they?
They do
say that.
They do.
You've had two, Derek's had two. Unfortunately, that screws the average for me and Garrity. We have to sadly remain bookless in order to keep it at one per person.
On a never-ending book, I'll die before that ever comes out of me. I'll just be one of those sad people.
You'll do it. Do it for yourself, even. I think that's the thing. Just do it for yourself keep going.
I think
going.
That's what
the published authors in the room telling us to self-publish. Yeah.
No, not even to self-publish. Just write it for yourself. Because you have to write the story you want to tell, and it doesn't, you know, and that's the one you get out of your system. I still write other stuff for myself that I may never try and get published. It's just there because you've ideas.
I've got one of those too, one that'll never be seen. It's like sometimes when I have writer's block, one of the ways around it is to write something really, really bad, intentionally bad, and then you actually realize you can't stop writing, and then some of it starts looking good.
But then
they went and published
good exercise.
It. I'm only kidding, award-winning author. It's okay.
No, I've done some Fatal Deviation fan fiction.
Oh God.
Oh, wow. Here's
are you familiar with Fatal Deviation?
I'm not Fatal Deviation. I know what fan fiction is.
Sorry?
Fatal Deviation is Ireland's premier martial arts movie. As in, I think it's Ireland's only martial arts movie. It is. It's in that territory of The Room and other movies that are so bad.
That's
brilliant.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. So, Fatal Deviation. It's entirely filmed and set in
Trim,
County Meath.
Oh, the hub
of
martial
Kung Fu,
arts.
Yeah. Ireland's Tai Chi and Kung Fu capital, Trim, County Meath.
Is that the one with one of the lads from Boyzone in
yes.
it.
Yeah.
And okay, wow. Mikey Graham is to do. Yeah, yeah. We got to do a live viewing of that. Like.
Yeah,
amazing.
Mikey Graham is the villain, but the opening credits. I guess he's thought these songs brought it. It says, you know, and Mikey Graham from Irish rock band Boyzone.
Oh yeah, no, that's pushing it.
I love that.
Rock Mikey out. I love the way that whoever made that film had obviously not only never heard of Boyzone, but had obviously also never seen a kung fu movie in their entire life.
But the but no,
no, it, you know that Mikey Graham had that in his rider. Like, he's like, I'm not partaking in this film unless I'm called a rock star. Like, there's no way I'm taking part in this film unless I get to be a rock star.
Yeah, nailed on. You have to call us a rock band. All right, fine.
We wore leather once.
When it comes to understanding political issues, I am a self-confessed toddler. That's why I've enlisted the help of Steve, my politically savvy drinking buddy, to help me better understand politics.
Every couple of weeks, we get together and record on topics like what is the politics of language, what is Watergate, how the internet is killing democracy.
We take these big issues and we break them down into silly little comedic bite-sized bits. If you like the sound of that, then search for What Am Politics in your podcast app of choice or find us here on the Headstuff Podcast Network.
There are some reviewers even of books who won't review. Now, most are fine, but yeah, there's a couple who, even if you give, and actually when their copies of the books are sent out to review, there would always be an English script yeah. with it, because just because we don't expect everyone to
because some reviewers are monolingual cultural imperialists.
And just decide, no, not for me. I can't review that. I can't possibly review it, even though it's in English in black and white in front of me. I can't review it.
These are the same people that'll happily review a Czech arthouse film.
Probably,
at
yeah.
The Lighthouse.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful. And you have to see it in the original Czech. Don't go to the dubbed version. That'll be, what's that, Gaeilge? I'm not touching that.
Yes, yeah.
But then you have to think about like who the audience is like, because I'm that annoying relative that like, so none of the like children in my family speak Irish, or none of the like other people in my family
yet.
Would speak Irish to their children yet. I haven't got a hold of them yet. But I'm that annoying relative that will always buy them like an Irish language something. No matter what it is, it's in the Irish language. Mm-hmm. And I can see the parents rolling their eyes at me because they're like, oh, yeah, okay, that's fine. That's very sweet and all, but I have to read it to them. And but the kids do not care that it's in Irish. They like that one because mm-hmm. there's fun sounds in it and the pictures are cool. And their parents are like, fuck, I'd have to read that Irish one again. Like, and I'm like, yes, you do. You're welcome. Like, so,
actually, that does raise a really interesting question though, because you're not marketing it at kids. Obviously, no. It's the kids that have to enjoy it,
mm-hmm.
but you need to grab the attention of an yes, adult compared absolutely. To all the other books on the bookshelf. So
yes.
how challenging is that?
That it, well, you're literally writing for two audiences. So you have both in mind. So when you're coming up with a story, it has to be something that make, like that reaction that you guys gave me when I said about being Bug Beeduck, being tiny. Oh my God, yeah, I'd love that. Because we all kind of have memories of that in us, of being small and wishing you could be a thing or, you know, turn into something, press your belly button and turn invisible. Whatever it is, you always have those ideas and you can still identify with them because you're still the same person. And then, but also a child would go, oh, well, I'd love to do that too. So you're always trying to find something. Obviously, my first book with the parental guilt in it, you know, that's pretty universal.
Yeah, that really resonates. Yeah.
So that's
playing
that's,
with you in a minute.
So that was easier to speak to two audiences in terms of the mommy just goes, like nearly every parent that I'm at events, family events, whatever, come up to me going, oh, that page with the, you know, the, when she realizes, I'm like, yeah, I know. Yeah. I know it's a true story.
And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon. Little boy blue in the pan.
Exactly. And then the kids identify with the kid trying to get their attention, basically. Yeah. So, yeah, but it is, you do have to have that. And I think books that are less successful don't do that because parents will go, oh God, I have to read this one again. Do you know, but you want the parent to enjoy reading it the 500 nights in a row because that's yes. sometimes what happens.
This is the thing. Generally speaking, yeah, there's a Pareto principle in that you will read kind of like 20% of a kid's books to them, maybe 80% of the time. The chances are there's a lot of books that you get one chance and then they're chucked
yeah.
hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and then where, and similarly that, like there are certain cartoons that will be watched over and over and over again and the others don't get a look in mm-hmm. at all.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I watched, we had a tape of An American Tale.
Oh, yeah.
And I pretty much watched it every single
Fievel?
Year. Fievel Moskowitz.
Yes.
First, oh, you go I to America, Fievel.
You do. You get obsessed.
Streets are paved with cheese.
Yeah. Yes. There are no cats in America. But I watched that. I probably watched that every single Saturday and Sunday morning for about 2 years.
Yeah.
It was a tape that my dad's friend had given us, and it was an American Tale and then several episodes of The Pink Panther.
Cool.
Afterwards, to fill up the blank tape.
Oh, yeah.
There's no point in wasting tape.
No, no. absolutely not.
You have
tape. No, you did not waste tape. But also, that when the tape recorders came out, you know, there's a don't tape over my thing.
Yes.
And one of the first things my father ever recorded when we got the tape was the funeral of Cardinal Fiach. And we didn't know who Cardinal Fiach was. We knew we got a day off in school because Cardinal died.
It was big news. I wrote it in my diary at that age. Cardinal Fiach died. And I was like, I don't know who it is. But it seems important.
This is like 1989.
Yeah.
Maybe this indicates what kind of school I went to compared to what kind of school I went to. We got a half day off when the Birmingham Six were released.
Oh, wow.
Nothing for Cardinal Fiach.
Oh, so much about who you are at this point.
I love that.
We got a half day and Seamus Heaney got a Nobel Prize, so that's just a different kind of a kettle of fish.
Yeah, that's different, all right. Yeah.
But yeah, so Cardinal O'Fierka passed away and Dad taped it, and Dad said, and Dad didn't, I guess he put it away, and one day Cardinal said, we wanted to watch something on television, and he said, oh, I'll just use this. No one's going to watch this funeral ever again. Oh, there was hell to pay.
I'd say.
There was hell to pay.
Yeah.
It was a historical moment recorded for all eternity.
It wasn't even a good funeral. The other way after, because that funeral was like, oh, it's lovely.
Yeah. It's lovely. You really felt the priest knew him. Like, really felt he knew him. Just reading off the page.
Is that ever true?
We had that. So we had American Tale, like that. We had American Tale, Fife and Mouskovitz. We had it recorded, but like half of it was like a leash match from 1993 on. So like, I did not know until I was about 20 years old and it was on telly one Christmas. I did not know how Feifel got to America. Like, I did not know that Feifel originated in Russia. I just thought they had cute accents. Like, why they were singing about this. Like,
so you thought,
and I was
basically,
like, oh my God, he's a little immigrant mouse. Like, now I get it.
So you thought that Cheddar Plunkett had a starring role in the first half of.
Wow.
Gary, I'm guessing this is one of the matches that Leash actually won, was it?
I think it might have been a match that my dad was actually playing in, so it would have been a junior B leash match. Yeah. So football, not hurling. Yeah. So I think, I can't remember why, like, we'd obviously fast forward through it to get to the match.
we had one tape for all my dad's TV appearances because he would occasionally play live at 3 when he was with the Dublin City Ramblers. So we had one tape, and it would never be watched again. It's for some reason
posterity.
We were recording these for posterity. Mm. I didn't realise that like VHS would become obsolete at some stage.
I know. Yeah. I heard a description, speaking of cartoon obsessions, my daughters are currently really into Steven Universe, which is kind of a really quirky, really good cartoon.
I believe
actually.
It's totes woke.
Oh,
though.
It's brilliant. It's so good. But there's one point where, I don't know exactly what the character's doing, but one of them says, you have to watch this video. And he says, what's that? And she says, it's like a DVD, but in a box. And I was like, that's a really, really good description.
As an author, actually, that really makes me wonder. As an author, how do you future-proof your book? Because, like, you know, like phones that have cords and are attached to a number pad, that's not a thing kids are going to grow up experiencing, really.
No. So there's a mobile phone in my book because Mommy answers the phone, but it's very nondescript. It's like
a black box.
That's up to the illustrator.
I think that's kind of universal though. You don't want it to absolutely look like a Huawei.
Then
like the US government kills Huawei and nobody's gonna ever have a Huawei again.
It's just a very generic shape, just a dark shape.
You better hope mobile phones don't get obsolete.
I know. Well, they probably will. We'll all have chips in our brains or something.
That'll make books obsolete as well. So your problem will be solved then. Isn't beam it directly to your
it's
cornea?
Your brain. Oh God! So
isn't
terrifying.
That in The Cat in the Hat? Doesn't say he's when they're cleaning the house and wasn't it Daddy's $7 shoes? I was like, if I get a pair of shoes for $7 now, I'd be
thanks,
like,
pennies.
Thanks, pennies. Exactly. In the sales section of pennies.
It's funny though when you look at so many films and so many books and so many, where the plot entirely hinges on something that's completely and totally obsolete now. Like,
oh, listen, I literally just finished watching, we have the HBO app, HBO Nordic app, and I just finished watching The Wire, And like, man, is it outdated?
Tap and pay phones.
First of all, they're Americans concerned about privacy. Like, red flag number one. Like, and like, it literally, season one, they have typewriters and they're talking about how they might be getting computers soon and they all have pagers. And I'm like, what is this technology? Like, it started in 2002, I think. So it was right after 9/11.
Mobile phones were prohibitively expensive in the
America,
States. I remember talking to people. You know, talking to people from the States when I was a teenager, like I bought my first mobile phone with a pay packet from the pub I was working in when I was 16.
Yeah.
So I went down and bought a Philips Savvy.
Oh, nice.
Absolutely.
I had an Alcatel.
An Alcatel. Old school. And I remember talking to people online because you'd go onto these chat rooms on Microsoft and talk to people from all over the world when the internet was new and shiny. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I got a mobile phone. I was like, oh my God, how can you afford a mobile phone? I was like, because I'm not Yank.
Yeah. Everyone had pagers when I was there in the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm. And I had a pager, actually.
You had a pager?
I had a pager when I was in sixth year and first year.
That's so cool.
It's, the big thing was...
Was it a mini call?
It was... Oh, I don't know what it was. It was useless.
Well, that's because you'd nobody ringing you.
Yeah,
like
my parents going, call home, you've been in college for 3 days and we haven't seen you.
In America at the time, I remember the late 90s, because I was looking at the word, the origin of text as a verb and for my second book. And one of the things was that local calls were free in America.
Yes.
So this really kind of restricted the early growth of mobile phones compared to in Ireland, mm-hmm. when I suppose it was fairly easy. There was kind of initially one supplier, then we had kind of a small market, but then it also cost money to receive a text message in America. If someone sent you six texts in a row, they was going to cost you money to read them.
Whereas it was free to dial and to receive on a non-long distance.
You could go into like a cafe and say, can I use your phone to make a local call? And they'd let you. And what you'd do is you'd leave answer phone messages and then your friend would ring their phone and you could hack in, you could access your voicemails mm-hmm. from your phone. Oh. So that was how you just leave voice messages for each other. Really, really like loads of effort, but free.
And completely and totally obsolete now because everyone has mobile. So like the entire idea, like I think literally every episode of Seinfeld revolves around, oh my God, I can't believe you left a message on a ransom phone.
I know.
Like, we have to get into our house and delete a ransom phone. Oh.
Nobody leaves voice messages for anyone. No one listens to them anyway.
You left me a voice message? Are you a psychopath?
No. I'm not going to listen to that, right?
But this is actually why more and more crime stories are set in the past. We have more deep dive old crime stories. Oh, yeah, I think things like West Cork and Serial are so popular. And even when No Country for Old Men came out, they said that actual modern, it's very hard to make it a standard satisfying police thriller using modern technology because the police have so much information in people's lives now.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, it's terrifying. Even like...
So you have to go back to when they weren't as good at catching criminals.
Well, there wasn't as much evidence, I suppose. Their evidence was easier done away with.
But even during the 90s when it's like, okay, we need to keep him on the line for 2 minutes so we can find out
what's
the call.
Trace the call. He's getting off at 159, boys. He's getting off... Lads, he's getting off... Just hang up now. He's getting off at one... It's a payphone anyway. It's a payphone anyway.
The actual use of Google or of payphones, because obviously I'm living in Finland now where they've had Nokia for such a long time that like payphones have not existed. Like there aren't in Finland anymore. They do not exist here. So my other half always finds a gas when he sees those like old telecom Aaron payphones in Ireland when he comes to Ireland. He's like, oh my God, like nostalgia. Like, but it's just so weird to see people actually using them. And I'm like, where would they even get change for a payphone nowadays? I use my tap on my card all the time. Like, how do people exist in this world? They have to carry around coins, they have no phone, they have to use a payphone, they have to remember numbers.
I remember reading a thriller, I can't remember who wrote it, it may have been a Jeffrey Archer book, but they identified a body as an FBI agent because he had a roll of quarters in his pocket, and every FBI agent had a roll of quarters because they needed to use payphones to phone the field office.
All the time.
Wow. I was kind of like, wow, that's dated.
That's heavy. That's
immediately dated.
And heavy lopsided suits.
Yeah. Oh, you're carrying a gun. I see him.
Is that a roll of quarters in your pocket?
Oh, God.
So I have police vintage police thriller next.
Do you know, totally listened to loads of crime. And I went down to Listowel Writers Week with a crime writer friend of mine, Andrea Mara. And we went down for a holiday kind of. And because I was with her, we ended up going to all the crime stuff, which is great. And I was like, oh, I must try and figure out how to fit an L murder into a children's book. But
if you're going to grow with your readers.
Yes.
Yeah, do a J.K. Rowling on it now, you know.
Well, one of my favourite children's authors, I guess he's a children's author, he's very dark, is a guy called Edward Gorey. Gorey as in Gorey down in Wexford, but he was from Boston, I think.
Oh.
And he wrote all these really dark, kind of twisted and illustrated, wrote and illustrated these stories, very unusual. But he has an alphabet book, and every page, so every letter, a child dies. So I'm like, if he can get away with that, like A is for Amy, who fell down the stairs.
Oh.
B is for Basil, assaulted by bears.
And it rhymes?
Yes, the whole thing. It's amazing. It's called the Gashly Crumb Tinies. And they all die, like run through with awls. They drink lye by mistake. There's all these kind of really weird things. But I'm like, I'd kind of like to go there.
But children do respond to that really dark stuff.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's one of the reasons Roald Dahl has been so enduringly popular.
Yeah.
Because they're all little psychopaths.
I think it's really important because...
Every single one of them.
The trick is to keep your objectionable dating opinions off the page. That's how Roald Dahl has done so much better than Enid Blyton in some ways.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
So Roald Dahl hid the racism, and that makes it fun.
Just remember, as long as you don't say it, you can get away with thinking things. Oh God! No! You can't. Don't think bad things.
No.
Yeah, let's not John, do them. Please, Roald Dahl, please.
Yes,
that happens. Roald Dahl was a terrible person. Has nobody heard this? He's absolutely. I still love his books. I absolutely adore.
Don't do it to me, Dara. Don't.
It's not me. It's Potter.
It's me.
Sorry.
I would still read. Was it Revolting Rhymes? And the other one. And again, he had a great relationship with an illustrator, Quentin Blake, who just gave it that iconic look, that Roald Dahl book look, which
and
is
that
just
David Walliams stole.
He
uses him as well. Well, he uses Tony Ross as well. But.
Yeah, that does upset me a little bit because it's so funny how sometimes you come to associate an illustrator with an author. Like when I see books in a shop now with Quentin Blake illustrated, like you immediately know it's Quentin Blake.
Yeah.
Or when I was a child, when I was like a teenager, child / teenager, I used to read a lot of Jacqueline Wilson, who would always use Nick Sharratt. So anytime I see those illustrations, I'm like, oh, it's one of those books, and then it's not. And I'm like, who is this imposter?
I know.
Stop trying to be Roald Dahl.
I suppose, though, like Quentin Blake didn't die. He used to still earn
money and live. No, Quentin, it's penury for you. The breadline for you,
live
I'm afraid.
Your royalties. Your
like Smithers being buried with Mr. Burns. Yeah. But the Quentin Blake illustrations do imply that Williams is the heir to Roald Dahl and.
He isn't his hoop.
Yeah.
I've only realised that David Williams is the celebrity author we were talking about earlier on. Sorry.
Sort of. Like, there's several, but yeah.
Yeah, but he's used some really unhelpful ableist language. I mean, which would have been bad enough 20, 30 years ago when you could say, ah, sure, back then, you know, anything went. Whereas now, I mean,
just should do better. Like,
yeah, I mean, he should do better. Well, I think so. It's certainly, you know, it's like we didn't, when I went to friends' houses, one of the things I noticed, my other friends had Enid Blyton books. We had no Enid Blyton in our house. There's obviously the dad put the foot down.
Tans.
Okay. Yes. I mean, no. There were other English authors were fine, well, but just Enid Blyton had a very specific worldview.
Yes.
Which was expressed, and the fact that the books were advocating and celebrating, and you know, a particular worldview between the Gollywog problem and then the other issues in the Famous Five, and that kind of particular view of history, and which
I read Secret Seven books. That was the only Enid Blyton stuff I read, and the assorted stories. There was no Noddy in my house. I think largely because it was kind of even by the mid '80s, it's a bit like, no, we can't.
Mm.
Can't really jive with that, like that's not cool, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, if you're a children's author and you are a children's author, so answer me this. If it gets to the stage where somebody's saying, you know, maybe that entire concept that you're writing about is a little bit problematic, you sort of have to go, oh, hang on a second, I should rethink this whole thing.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you take on board. And, you know, that's the nice thing about working in children's books and working in books in general. I'm sure you've found the same, Derek. It's not just me. You know, I may have come up with the, written the story, but like there's the illustrators, the publishers, there's the editors, there's designers, yeah. there's a lot of people. It's a real team effort. And I think at some point, if there is something problematic, people are going to go, here, that's not working, like, or that's, you know, that's not right, or
yeah.
some, or that's, it just won't get picked up. it's even slightly. There are actually loads of issues, like in there's safety issues and stuff in books that you can't depict a child, say, in a dangerous situation that a another child might mimic.
Yes.
So, for example, there's okay. like a page in one of my books where the child is making an invention. And in the first iteration of the illustration, she was teetering on a little kind of footstool ladder kind of thing as she was reaching to do something. And it was like, well, that's not safe, actually. And now she has a very safe, in the final illustration, there's a very safe thing that she's standing on. So it's there's so many different things that you just wouldn't even think of. Until everybody looks at it and goes, actually, that looks a bit dangerous.
There's an episode of Peppa Pig that doesn't get shown in Australia because there's an episode which has, oh, don't be afraid if it's only a spider. A spider's not going to hurt you.
Yes.
Oh, my. Oh, my. That spider's going to fucking kill you. Peppa, mate. Yeah. Peppa. Don't.
Yes. Mr. Skinny Legs.
Yeah, so it's...
And there was a Volkswagen commercial years ago. It was absolutely brilliant. It was a hilarious one. It was about this little girl. It was going around saying bollocks, and everywhere she went, she was just saying bollocks, and she kept saying bollocks. And in one scene, she's reaching up to get a biscuit out of the biscuit jar, and it all falls down, and she goes bollocks. And the punchline is, her dad drives a Volkswagen Golf, and he keeps forgetting that it's a diesel, and he keeps putting petrol in because it performs so well, it feels like a petrol car. And all she sees, she's in the car seat. In the back, and he puts petrol in. He goes, "Oh bollocks!" And that's where she learned it. But it was pulled from UK television, not because of the bad language, but because in the scene where she's reaching for the cookie jar, she's reaching over her head,
okay.
and that shows a child doing something that's unsafe. So it wasn't allowed to be broadcast, which is hilarious.
Oh, I love that.
And we're right back to children mimicking their parents and the guilt associated.
This is. And Saeed, you wrote an article about this. You wrote an article about a child using a swear word.
I did, yes. So, and you know, she's the most, like, if there ever one escapes our lips at home, she is like the police now. Mm. So she went through a phase, though, of using the F word and, like, been really into it. I think she just loved the sound of it and the shape of it in her mouth.
It's pretty great.
It
is pretty great.
She loved it and she was saying it loads, but it was just sort of not appropriate for what I think she was like 3 or 4. It was just not a good look for that age. So we were trying to encourage her to not, because she had used it in Nina, and the teacher was a bit like, would you have a word with her? And I was like, oh God, the shame.
She was just trying to say fuck up.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so our approach was to let her say it more. So, which seems counterproductive.
I'm sure Nina loved that.
Yeah, but we were like, the prohibition wasn't working. We all know it doesn't. So we kept saying, oh, don't say it. And it would just make her want to say it more. And she was getting really kind of frustrated. And that would just make her want to say it more. So we would let her say it, but she wasn't allowed to say it about anybody or to anybody. So she would kind of go off into a corner and go, and then if she felt it coming, like she was getting really upset.
This isn't a visual medium. I mean, you're telling everyone, so I've covered her mouth. Nobody can even lip read the fuck.
Through the airwaves. But yeah, so I'd let her get it out of her system, and then she'd come back all calm and be like, okay, I did it, I've said it. And then she kind of, she got it, it just stopped after a while. And now, like, if we're listening to podcasts and stuff, or list, you know, anything, because that's where you hear them, all the bad language.
Sorry. And,
well, especially her dad listens to a lot of comedy, American kind of comedians and stuff. On podcasts, and there's a lot of language, let's say, and she gives out to us all the time. She's like, you can't listen to that, stop listening to that, that's terrible language. So she's actually like fully come around the other way. It's quite funny, but yeah, she's filthy mouth.
Like, I think this will just like signify like how much I don't have children, but like I love teaching children swear words. Do not leave me alone with your child, because I will create a time bomb for it, like, and hopefully it will go off like in Nina or like in the middle of a shopping centre.
So before we wrap up, we like to ask our guests what their favourite Irish word is.
Oh God, I forgot about that. Yeah. So this again probably shows, I was talking about Edward Gorey and stuff like that. I always, as a child, my favourite Irish word was luffa, which is a weird one, I know, mm-hmm. but I just loved the sound of it. Again, like my daughter with the F word, the shape of it in your mouth, luffa. I always loved saying that. And I always felt like it didn't really match what it means, which mm-hmm. is rotten.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I've just always liked
it. It's really, really apt
word.
For like, you know, dirty.
Dirty, yeah. Luffa.
Even more than salach. Like,
oh, yeah. It's definitely
salach.
Salach, luffa, I think. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I don't know. It's an unusual choice, maybe.
That's a great choice.
We'll go with that. So, and before we finish up, we want to remind our listeners what your books are called and where they can get them.
Yeah. So, Bí Exprilum and Beag Bídach, available directly from futafata.ie.com, maybe. And from all good bookshops and libraries.
And if people want to find out more about you and the work you're doing outside of your children's books?
So I'm on Twitter at Where Wishes.
Thanks very much for joining us today, Sive. So until the next time, it's a slán from me.
It's a slán wemshe.
Slán wemshe.
One more time.
Sorry.
You go first, Gerrigan.
Okay, do you want to go first?
It's a slán from me.
It's a slán wemshe.
Okay,
it's Dara,
Derek,
Pater, Garadine, Sive.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so, okay, got it.
Until the next time, it's a slán from me.
Slán wemshe.
Slán from me.
And a slán from me.
Catch you next time. So, Sive, you have a bit of news for us.
I do. Very exciting news. So, I'm going to be the next writer in residence in DLR Lexicon.
Oh.
Which is this huge, amazing library in Dunleary. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm really excited. I start like next week.
This is a fantastic opportunity. Was Sarah Griffin there before?
Yeah, she's just coming up to the end of her tenure. Mm-hmm. Sarah Webb, I think, was before her. And it's absolutely huge. I don't think they've had an Irish language author before. So that's really nice, and it's just a massive endorsement, if you know what I mean.
Like, and three Manon in a row.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, go on.
That's it, exactly. So, yeah.
Wonderful. So, Mílaco gorgeous, and I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful year.
Gur Míle Mahagat.
Thank you very much for listening to today's episode. Motherfucker comes out every Friday on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. If you can't wait that long for your next podcast fix, there are some other shows coming out on Head Stuff which you might enjoy. For example, you might like What Am Politics. If you want to contact the show, you can email us at motherfolklore@headstuff.org, or you can hit us up at our various Twitter handles. We're not hard to find. There's the Irish Four and there's Motherfolklore both on Twitter. Thank you very much to Kirsten Shield for doing the art. Thank you to Brian for producing. And thank you to the backroom team at Headstuff for all the work they do. Until the next time, slán go fóill.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hold on. Hey, Dara.